From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. It is day 31 of the longest government shutdown in American history, and there are no signs of it coming to an end. Over the weekend, President Trump offered to temporarily extend protections for young immigrants who are brought to the country illegally as children. In exchange, he wants the $5 billion for his border wall. Democrats rejected the three-year proposal protecting DACA immigrants. They say it doesn't go far enough. They want the president to reopen the government first, then negotiate border security or barrier funding. Here to make sense of where we stand and look at where we're headed is Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Welcome back, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
I know it's a lot to ask of you to tell us where we stand and make sense of it right now, but we're going to do it anyway. The president made an offer. Democrats said no thanks. What's your take on his offer and the Democrats' rejection of it?
Yeah, the two are really negotiating different things. President Trump is obviously insisting on the wall and the money that would come from it. He's now thrown onto the table a temporary extension of a program that he himself dismantled. Democrats are really arguing before any of that, the process itself is not legitimate. You can't shut down the government and then make requests for things. That's not how the process works, and it's not legitimate. So the question is, do Democrats now take this opportunity and try to put together a package that they accept and the president will convince Republicans to move with, or do they hold firm? Because this is not working for the president. Public opinion so far has turned against him and the Republicans, not the Democrats.
Well, it's working for Mark Meadows. Republicans like him. He praised the plan. Meadows is the head of the conservative House Freedom Caucus. He says the ball is now in Democrats' court. On the other hand, as you said, there are some dissenters. Conservative commentator Ann Coulter calls the proposal on DACA amnesty for millions of illegals. The president responded with a tweet yesterday saying, no, amnesty is not part of my offer. To what extent do you think the president is being boxed in by different sides of his own party?
Well, he's clearly being boxed in by the House Republican caucus, which is, even with Meadows making these concessions, very firm against any serious immigration liberalization program. And I think the president understands if he sends anything beyond this, it's going to take a lot of work to get House Republicans to go along. That said, he does have the bully pulpit. He has leaned in on Republicans on other issues. So this could be a place he can actually move them. But he's in a difficult spot for sure. That said, he's not operating according to rational principle. This is very ideological and symbolic for him. And I think he wants to win, quote unquote, the fight.
Do you think that's why Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has, at least until this point, pretty much been absent?
So far, but there could be a point where he sees, in terms of partisanship, the calculation turns, and it's no longer in their interest to serve the president and to work with the president. We haven't hit that point at this moment, but so far the Republicans in the Senate are sitting tight and supporting the president.
Yeah, why haven't we hit this point so far? I mean, day 31 in, it's hurting a lot of people, and it's hurting a lot of politicians.
Well, Republican senators are still not seeing in their states that the polling is bad enough to suggest that they should turn against the president. I think it's very simple in that way. There's still support for the president fighting for the wall. There's still tolerance for the government being shut down. But every day, we literally will now feel more of an impact, not only government workers, but citizens who don't have government services. And so when an airport in a red state starts to really close down, that's when you have to look and see, is there movement in the electorate?
Is that what has made the difference in the past, in past government shutdowns? What have been the factors?
It did. In 1995-96, Republicans controlled Congress. Clinton was in the White House. You have a long shutdown, longest until now. And what really turned it was more and more news stories about what it meant not to have government, whether you were tourists and couldn't get into a national park, or it was basic services that people depend on not being there. And Republicans under Gingrich felt the pressure and caved.
But we're hearing those stories all the time, individual stories.
Well, that's true. And that's where, at least certainly from from the White House, he's not responding to those pressures. That said, it's been a partial government shutdown. The first real bite came with the paychecks not being delivered. It might take more time, and so we have to wait to see. But many people suffer in the meantime.
Julian, let's talk a little bit more about that. We've heard many stories of people who are suffering, families who are suffering. We're talking about 800,000 federal workers here, either furloughed or made to work without pay. They can be dire, these stories, but the larger picture, how much of a toll is this in aggregate taking on the federal workforce?
It's huge because it's not simply one paycheck missed. It's the uncertainty and instability of not knowing when the next one is coming. And so people make calculations about their finances, about their family. And so in addition to what happens today, you're wondering what happens 2 weeks out. And again, let's remember, this has a real-world impact on people who are not government workers, from food being inspected to airplanes being inspected to training the workforce for future crises. All of this is stalled right now. So the larger macro impact is enormous. This is not normal. And this is actually – this is a national crisis to have the government shut down this long.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He's co-author with Kevin Cruz of the new book Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Thank you, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
Well, switching gears, high rent is a big burden in many cities. Denver is no exception. A recent analysis shows half of the city's renters spend more than 30% of their paycheck on housing. City officials want to take action, but they're limited by a statewide ban on rent control. Colorado Public Radio's Sam Brash reports.
Denver City Councilman Paul Lopez took office in 2007, just before the Great Recession. He's watched the city go from housing bust to building boom. Now he's worried about who that recovery benefits.
I see all these cranes in Denver's skyline, and I'd feel a lot better about those cranes if I knew that at 20 to 25, maybe 30% of those units were at an affordable and attainable level.
That kind of policy is known as inclusionary housing. A city says you can build if you help us create more affordable places to live. Not long after he took office, Lopez proposed a measure that required developers to add cheaper rental units to certain projects. And
I don't know how many lawyers told me you can't do that. I don't know how many policy people told me over and over again that we can't do that.
The reason is that Colorado bans local governments from regulating rents. Most states have similar policies. Colorado's is especially far-reaching thanks to a decades-old state Supreme Court decision. It says a city can't force developers to set aside affordable units as a part of new rental projects. Communities can have inclusionary housing policies, but they have to offer developers alternatives, like letting them donate land or pay cash into an affordable housing fund. Lopez wants Denver's policy to have more teeth.
If we can't do it now, how can that be possible? How can this tool be unlocked?
And Lopez says the answer is a change in the law. And now he has an ally at the state capitol.
I think that municipalities should be able to have a full set of policy options to decide what makes the most sense for them.
This is State Senator Julie Gonzalez of Denver. She's part of a new class of progressive Democratic lawmakers elected to Colorado State House last November. And she's working on a bill that scraps the statewide rent control ban entirely, opening the door to rent regulation for the first time in more than 30 years. Advocates say that'll set off some alarm bells.
I mean, obviously, rent control is kind of a stigmatized topic.
That's Andrea Chiribogo-Flor, a housing organizer with 9to5 Colorado. The group is part of a coalition pushing Gonzalez's bill and says rent control doesn't mean freezing or rolling back rents, but it would let cities limit rent increases.
It could be a cap increase of 5% a year. It could be a temporary stabilization of rent. And that's why we really think it makes sense to give local control so cities can address it the way that makes sense in each city.
That way, she says Denver could craft policies to slow gentrification, or ski towns could look for ways to build housing for workers. But opponents say it's not so simple.
Rent control is a policy which feels good, it sounds good, it's easy to understand. But rent control has disastrous consequences.
Teo Nicolai is a landlord and vice president for the Apartment Association of Metro Denver. He says price controls can actually hurt renters. And to explain why, he says,
you should think of housing as a game of musical chairs.
People are wandering around looking for a seat, and when the music stops,
when there aren't enough seats to go around, that's when we run into trouble.
It's basic economics, he says. Prices go up when demand outstrips supply.
And the solution to musical chairs is simply add more chairs.
In other words, to stop rising rents, make more housing. Nikolai says rent control makes that harder because developers have less reason to build new units. One Stanford study of rent control in San Francisco found it may have actually accelerated gentrification as landlords replaced apartments with high-end units or condos to avoid the rent caps.
As a Denver native, as a citizen of the city, and as someone who is a kind of a nerd on housing policy, I don't like to see bad policy, and rent control is bad policy.
And key lawmakers at the state capitol agree. Democratic State Senator Angela Williams represents Northeast Denver and chairs the Senate's Business Committee. She says Colorado should address the rising cost of living, but
I don't think that city and county should be in the business of telling businesses how to run their businesses.
That means scrapping or modifying Colorado's rent control ban could be a tough sell, even with Democrats now in full control of state government. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash.
Communities are marking the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, including in Atlanta, where he was born on January 15, 1929, and where Delta Airlines has donated money to open up the spaces dedicated to him that were closed by the government shutdown. Dr. King is also being remembered where his life ended, Memphis, Tennessee, where he was assassinated on April 4, 1968. He was in Memphis to support striking sanitation workers. He spoke the night before he died.
The question is not, if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question.
Dr. King had asked that question in Memphis about other groups of people, bus drivers, political candidates. Otis Sanford, professor of journalism at the University of Memphis, remembers two other visits King made to the city, and we want to listen back now to our earlier conversation with him. King came to Memphis in 1957 and 1959 in his 20s, gave two big speeches, highly anticipated. I asked Professor Sanford to start first with that 1957 visit, which King made just after the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott ended.
Yes, it was. And actually, that was when he was just emerging onto the national scene. The boycott had lasted some 381 days, as most people recall. It ended successfully with the end of discrimination. Three African-American fraternities in Memphis reached out to him. Again, he was 28 years old at the time, and asked him to come to Memphis to speak to African Americans in Memphis, not just about the successful bus boycott in Montgomery, but also about the growing civil rights movement throughout the South that Memphis was poised to take advantage of.
Well, and you mentioned there was a Supreme Court decision that ended discrimination that was on buses, and the boycott had been in response to the arrest of Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat to a
rider.
Blacks were told they had to sit in the back of the bus, so they didn't get on the bus at all. And that really hit the industry hard. And finally, a court ruled that the segregation, the discrimination on the public buses was unconstitutional. This is a huge victory in this, as you say, burgeoning civil rights movement. So what was the buzz in Memphis when this 28-year-old Martin Luther King was going to come to town?
Well, in the African-American community, Robin, it was buzzing with excitement in the black community. There was a lot of angst in the white community, and there was a little bit of fear there would be some unrest. But again, this was an event that was put together by African-American educators here in town, the black fraternities. It was never intended to be some protest march. It was really an event for the city to really get to know Dr. King and his emerging leadership of the civil rights movement.
And 1,700 people did come out to hear his speech.
Yes.
And he talked about the bus boycott. Some of his beautiful lines were spoken that night about walking versus riding.
Yes, he did. I mean, the one that I remember the most, he said, it is better to walk in dignity than to ride in humiliation.
Yeah.
And that statement to me goes even beyond just the bus boycott. It spoke to all of the issues surrounding civil rights, the lunch counter demonstrations, the desegregation of schools. I mean, all of it had to do with dignity as opposed to humiliation.
That was in 1957. 1959, he comes back again and spoke to a full crowd at the Mason Temple. There were African-American candidates in that year's city election, one of them Russell Sugarman, running for a seat on the city commission. Lots of anxiety this time around.
Oh, yes. Russell Sugarman and Ben Hooks, who is obviously the very nationally known civil rights leader in his own right. They were running to become the first African-American elected officials in the city. And Russell Sugarman, who's still alive and had the best shot to win because there were no runoffs, and he was the only African-American candidate against five white candidates. And the voting numbers would have favored him. And Dr. King and Russell Sugarman went to college together at Morehouse. And that's how he got Dr. King to come to town to speak at a rally just about a week or two before the election. There were a huge number of people. It was a packed audience at Mason Temple that night. And he exhorted the crowd to turn out in huge numbers to support that entire African-American ticket. It was called the Volunteer Ticket. That was running to win seats.
Well, but the anxiety on the white side of town was, as you said, that the whites would split the votes in the run against Sugarman and he would emerge the winner. So the whites scrambled and convinced one of the white candidates to drop out.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, it was led by the future mayor. He wasn't the mayor at that time, but he really didn't have any opposition. A guy by the name of Henry Loeb, whose name pops up later on because he was the mayor during the sanitation strike. But in 1959, he was running basically unopposed as mayor because the incumbent mayor got sick and dropped out. Mm-hmm. He was the one that led the effort for other white city commission candidates to get out because, in his words, it would not be good to have what he called the Negro on the city commission. And one of the white candidates did eventually get out.
So what are you saying to Memphians? Because, again, the day that everyone does think of is 1968, when he'd come to support sanitation workers and was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel. You know, what do you want Memphians to take out of this reminder of their history?
The reason I wrote about that, Robin, is that I wanted Memphians to, most Memphians, and not just Memphians, but most people, only associate Dr. King with Memphis with 1968. But the fact is, Dr. King cared a lot about this city of Memphis. He cared and he knew a lot of people here. His quest for justice and equality started long before he was asked to come here and support the sanitation workers. And he did so. So I just wanted to remind Memphians and basically remind the nation that Dr. King, as a very, very young man, was willing to go anywhere that it demanded in order to try to bring about racial justice, desegregation, and unfairness. And he did that in Memphis years before the assassination in 68.
Well, and just what about Memphis today? One of the poorest large cities in America, 60% of the population African-American. 200 homicides in Memphis last year, 142 were African-Americans. You know, what would Martin Luther King see? What would his legacy be?
Well, I mean, I think that obviously he would be despondent over the crime issue, not just here, but in other places. I'm sure he'd be despondent about the killings in Chicago, the killings in Baltimore, or anywhere else. I mean, and Memphis is no different from that. And Memphis does have its issues with crime. It has other issues as well. And a lot of it breed the crime. Poverty, lack of quality and adequate public education in the inner city, lack of high-paying jobs. There's a lot of youth violence that nags the city as well. I think that he would be talking about those issues. I think he would be working with communities to try to address those concerns. He certainly would be pushing for better wages. That's why he was here for the sanitation workers. They were, as a matter of fact, his statement that night in that last speech had to deal with starvation wages, as he said, that the sanitation workers were receiving. So I think he would be addressing these issues in a very strong way.
Well, but we also have Nazis and white supremacists emboldened to march in public. We have videos that cell phone videos that have revealed police brutality against unarmed African Americans. Not all police, of course, but really disturbing cases. We've had kids marching to say that their lives matter. We've also seen a move to examine the justice system and how many young blacks have been sent to jail as opposed to their white counterparts for sometimes the same crime. Is he weeping? You know, I mean.
I always hesitate to say with a lot of specificity about how Dr. King would see today's America. But I have to think that he would look at this and see that we have regressed in a lot of ways. We have taken several steps forward since his assassination, I think in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, and certainly into the 2000s with the election of Barack Obama. There was certainly hope that we were getting somewhere here as it relates to racial equality and certainly equal justice. But now, and for whatever reason, I mean, there is this backlash. White supremacists, white nationalists, the Ku Klux Klan, the neo-Nazis, they're emboldened more now to express their views. I think they have political cover to do it. And all of those things are very, very depressing. I think Dr. King would be very upset about that, but he would be speaking out against it as he did in the 60s.
That's Otis Sanford, professor of journalism at the University of Memphis. His latest book is From Boss Crump to King Willie, How Race Changed Politics in Memphis. And we'll link you to his article on the Memphis history with MLK at hereandnow.org. Professor, thank you, and have a thoughtful day.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate talking with you.
Our conversation from last year.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Let's take a break from the winter cold now and head to Jamaica, the country known for its crystal waters and reggae music, and now for its stock exchange. The Jamaican Stock Exchange is the highest performing in the world, and some are wondering if a new day has dawned for the Jamaican economy.
Check it out. Low and stable inflation is to the economy what the baseline is to reggae music.
That jingle is from the Jamaican Central Bank. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, got to hear that and more on his recent trip to Kingston. And you can't say that every central bank has its own theme music, Mike, but that's a pretty good one.
That's the first one I've heard. Certainly the catchiest, too. So,
absolutely. So how did this story land on your desk?
I got to say, I was completely out of ideas one day. And I had the thought in my head, well, what's the best performing stock market this year? And I looked it up and I was very surprised to see it was Jamaica's. And in fact, I was surprised to learn that they even had a stock market. I didn't even realize this. And then I looked back and realized that it's not just 2018. It was over the past 5 years, the exchange, their main index is up almost 300%. So really blowing away every stock market out there. So I started joking, well, I really should go down to Jamaica in say, December, January or some other cold month and investigate. And the more I joked about it, the more I realized I really should. There's some story here, and I really need to figure out what it is.
Well, it's an interesting story and I guess potentially a big one. We'll find out how significant it is. But you're right that the Jamaican Stock Exchange outperformed the S&P 500 by a factor of 7 over the past 5 years. It's presumably small. How is this possible?
Yes, it's a very small market. The entire value of all 37 companies in the main index is about $10 billion U.S. dollars. So that's smaller than, say, one company like Chipotle Mexican Grill is the example I gave.
And what companies are traded on the exchange in Jamaica?
So the biggest companies are the banks. NCB Financial is sort of the dominant bank. And then the Bank of Nova Scotia, the Canadian bank, has a subsidiary that's has its stock listed. But there's a variety of sort of agricultural companies that are listed. Jamaica Producers Group exports bananas and other produce. And Jamaica Broilers is a poultry exporter.
So how does this portend for the future of the economy?
So that's the big question. And, you know, there's this great expression in Patois Jamaican that's we lickle but we talawa. And what it means is we're small but we're fearless. And it's almost become like a national motto. It, you know, they have this ambitious plan to boost their manufacturing, their services, and they often invoke Singapore as an example. Another tiny tropical island country that managed to really develop itself into this international financial hub in a very short time. You know, there's a lot of aspirations there and a lot of green shoots for the economy, as they say.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News and author of the article, The Jamaican Stock Exchange is the World's Best Performing Market. Thanks very much, Mike. And we're going to leave you with the Jamaican Stock Exchange anthem.
JSC, for you and me, business owners, investors, get on board. Benefit by listing and investing, Jamaica Stock Exchange, Jamaica Stock Exchange.
Commuters in Seattle are entering week two of what the city is calling the period of maximum constraint. Residents call the Seattle squeeze, and much worse, as the Alaskan Way Viaduct comes down, a major renovation project to replace a stretch of the elevated highway downtown. It formally closed 2 weeks ago. The sound as thousands of people gathered on and around the highway for an impromptu farewell. Some say they're going to miss the viaduct, but crews are busy tearing it down to replace it with a bi-level tunnel, all because back in 2001, the viaduct suffered damage in a massive earthquake. It was deemed safe, but seismically vulnerable. Yikes. Let's learn more about this huge $3.3 billion project to switch to tunnels with Mark Hallenbeck, director of the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington. Mark, this is your life for the foreseeable future.
This is my life for the foreseeable future, yes. We like to, in traffic congestion world, we like to think of it as job security. But since we also live in it, it's always not necessarily a pleasant thing.
So, how long is it going to take?
Yes. Well, the period of maximum constraint is 3 weeks. The ramps to the viaduct come down so that the roadway that leads to it can be redirected to the tunnel. So the tunnel is completed and waiting to be used, but you have to connect the new roadway to the existing roadway. Yeah. So after 3 weeks, the tunnel opens. There are still several more weeks of adding additional ramps that can't be done until the rest of it is done. And then at some point in the early spring, then they'll start tolling it, and that will be the next time of potential viadoom.
Viadoom, that's another thing it's being called. I shouldn't laugh. Here in the Boston area where we are, they lowered 93 that ran through the city, this huge rusty green thing. The upset it can cause. There in Seattle, you have 90,000 cars that use this road.
So it's kind of like the Olympics, because if everybody travels the way they would typically travel, traffic congestion will be horrendous. So you want people to telecommute. You want them to switch to the bus if they can, or anything other than drive their car alone.
There's going to be a light rail expansion set to open part of it in 2021. There's 600 daily buses.
So when the light rail opens, buses have to come out of the joint light rail tunnel and up onto the surface streets of Seattle. And that's a problem when surface streets are already relatively congested.
Yeah.
So there are lots of changes in traffic that are occurring in the Seattle area. They're trying to figure out where to put everybody. The good news about economic expansion, which we've been doing for quite a while now, is a healthy economy and everybody has a job. The bad news is traffic sucks. So,
well, and talk about the viaduct itself. People talk about it now with some nostalgia. There's kind of a nostalgia movement going on in Seattle in general, because you've had such a boom there because of Amazon, that people are looking at things like this monster with some affection. I'm reading a woman, Kelly Mucklestone. She works in Pike Place Market.
She says, I liked it. It represents the grit of old Seattle. There's a certain thrill in feeling like you might die on your way to Costco. Talk about driving on this thing. It was heart thumping.
Yes and no. You have to decide, you know, the Clint Eastwood quote, do you feel lucky, punk? And it was designed to get through traffic out of the way of the very industrial, active waterfront of Seattle. The Embarcadero in San Francisco was a great example. I-880 on the other side of the Bay Area in Oakland's an example of putting a lot of freeway capacity, which we were interested in as little space as we could. But the downside of it in an earthquake zone is what happened in Oakland on I-880.
And in Oakland, it collapsed.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And lucky for them, even though it collapsed during rush hour, it was during the Oakland A's, San Francisco Giants World Series game, and very few people were on the freeway. So the Seattle Viaduct, the southern end of it, sits on unstable soil. But people didn't understand unstable soil when it was built in the 1950s. So the viaduct has come close to falling down in not just the earthquake you talked about at the beginning, but then earlier earthquakes as well. And so from a public health, public safety perspective, it does need to be removed.
Plus an aesthetic perspective. I mean, you're there on the Puget Sound. It's beautiful. You can see the mountains, you know, across the water. And Gregory Scruggs has this great line in the City Lab. He says the problem is that it blocked this view. Famous fish throwers in the market could nail a Subaru with a sockeye. They were so close to it in the fish market.
True.
So taking it down will do what to that area?
The answer to all urban transportation planning questions is it depends. So it depends. If you're driving in one direction, if you're on the top level, when you have this spectacular view, and many of the people who defended keeping the viaduct love the spectacular view as you drive along. If you're underneath, you don't have that view because you're in the middle of this, you know, hulking structure.
Plus, it's claustrophobic.
Plus, it is claustrophobic. And if you're on top, when it falls down, you fall on top of people as opposed to being in the middle where you get crushed by the concrete. But when you take that away, you get the whole waterfront opens up to the city, which from a city quality of life perspective is spectacular. It's a huge win for living in the area.
So this is happening after a big political battle, but it, as you said, started happening when the tunnel was dug by the world's biggest boring machine, B-O-R-I-N-G. And then you're going to have these hydraulic munchers that are going to remove the girders and columns. And the pictures are incredible of, you know, how this is going to be taken down. Bring your kids, I would say.
But as a demolition person, it's not going to be nearly as exciting as when we blew up the kingdom. I mean, there's no set off the explosions, kaboom, 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 and the whole thing comes crashing down. I mean, that you can't beat that. But this is a much more Pacific Northwest, passive-aggressive kind of way of taking a structure down.
Is the hope that people, when it's finished, the tunnels open, that people maybe keep up some of this behavior they've had to start because of this, riding their bikes, taking the bus or the water taxi?
Yeah, that's actually quite true. One of the things we were hoping would happen, at least me as a transportation professional was hoping people would do, is experiment during this time in order to make your commute better. 10 years ago, I moved to where I could ride my bike to work. It's 12 minutes. It's uphill going home. It's one of the best things about my day is this 12 minutes of paying attention to how hard I'm working, riding my bike up the hill, where the traffic is because I don't want to die. But by the time I get home, the stress of work has gone away. But you'd never know that until you did it.
Well, meantime, Mark Hollenbeck, again, of the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington. More about that nostalgia that seems to be growing up. There's an artist. She actually was a commuter who took all these photographs while driving and turned them into this artwork. She's showing it at the Brian Ono Gallery. And it's called 53 Views of the Alaska Way Viaduct. Most of it's been sold. And there's a couple. They call themselves The Argument. They released a song that they wrote, Oh Viaduct. We're going to hear a little bit of it. Some of the lyrics, they said you'd fall and kill us all, but you were tried and true. I mean, just your sense of the nostalgia that people are going to have there in Seattle.
So Seattle is we've led the nation in construction cranes for the last 5 years in a row. So there's a tremendous amount of change taking place in the city. And change is tough on people. We like a little change in the change we choose. We don't like other people changing stuff on us. And it's tough on many people. So, yeah, there's nothing wrong with nostalgia. There's nothing wrong with historical preservation. On the other hand, the objective is to not kill people. And for the viaduct, that actually is the key issue.
That's Mark Hallenbeck, director of the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington. Mark, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
And good luck to you guys there in Seattle with your Viadoom or whatever you call it. Thank you.
The Viadoom. That was, I didn't invent any of these. But you have to remember that we have our first streetcar line was initially suggested as being called South Lake Union Transit, which had the unfortunate acronym of being the slut. So people quickly started putting T-shirts out. There was a coffee shop that quickly copyrighted Ride the Slut was the T-shirt. So, you know, the whole never underestimate the value of a really cool name.
Never underestimate the value of a cool name. Well, as promised, Oviaduct, another cool name by the Seattle couple with a very cool name, The Argument.
It's day 31 of the government shutdown with still no deal in sight. The president takes pride in his negotiation skills, and they are being put to the test now. So we're going to take a look at whether those skills are serving him well. Richard Schell, professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He's author of several books on negotiation. Professor, Donald Trump described himself as a great negotiator during the campaign, and he talks about winning above all else. I realize that may sound coarse to a negotiator, but wouldn't any business person want exactly that, to win?
There are two things. One is winning, and the other is the other party having to lose. And although if you're running a race, there can only be one winner. In a negotiation, it's often the case that each side gets something of what they want. So having a requirement that the other side utterly be defeated narrows the range of possibilities quite a lot. And I think I don't know, and I haven't studied the leaders of the House of Representatives, but I have studied Donald Trump, and he's been this way for a long time. It's a very, very deep personality trait of his that his version of being competitive is this very narrow version of it, which is he only thinks he's won when the other side's lost.
So how well has that served him in the past?
Well, he's got two gifts that make it possible for him to function this way as a negotiator. One is that he's very, very talented at dominating the agenda in the media. And that's been true ever since he started doing his real estate work in New York City in the 70s. And the other is that as a competitive person, he has an instinct, a very refined intuition about finding the high ground in terms of leverage. High ground, not meaning moral high ground, I mean competitive advantage high ground. And when he was a real estate developer, that meant finding a property right, whether it was a option or whether it was a parcel of land, that he could control, that gave him a kind of, you've got to come to me place on the board. So whenever he sees that kind of opportunity and he can get to it first, that gives him a chance to play this game where he wins and everybody else loses.
But it sounds like you're saying that at least when he was purely a business person, it did serve him well.
It did. You know, who knows what kind of a success he might have been beyond what the level he reached, which was pretty sporadic. He was up again, down again, up again, down again. He ended up in bankruptcy 15 times, I think. One of my favorite statistics about Trump as a business person, between 1986 and 2016, 30 years, he either filed or was a defendant in 4,095 lawsuits, which is roughly a lawsuit every 3 days for 30 years. He used the legal system as a habitual tool to shift the table in terms of advantage, either inflicting costs on others, which helped him think he was winning, or just using the legal system to delay his own need to pay or to come to terms with any agreement he might have made that he no longer found convenient. But in the presidency, the analogies for the kinds of things that made it work for him in business are pretty different. There are very few property rights. There are very few places that are unambiguous in terms of forcing others to come to you. I think the government shutdown is a classic example of him finding one. He finally realized, I control shutting the government down. That will force people to come to me. And so he's playing the game that he used to play in business.
So the game of brinkmanship, and is any of this serving him well right now?
I would say the only area where his experience is perhaps relevant is in trade disputes, because tariffs are kind of imposition of costs that are analogous to what a legal lawsuit would look like. And so he's been pretty active, once he found that lever, in imposing costs on our trading partners in order to get them to come to the table and to modify the agreements that he doesn't like. And he's actually been reasonably successful at getting concessions using those tools.
And then bring that to the case of the shutdown and where things stand right now, which is it seems to be going nowhere fast.
Yeah, the shutdown is, I think, an example of Trump making a series of mistakes and then finding that he has to somehow back his way out. He had a deal in December, but then he got burned by his own base, and so he had to back out of it. And at the current situation we've got, he's basically trying to give back to the Democrats what he already agreed to back in December and make it look as if it's a concession. And I do think the Democrats are engaging in wishful thinking if they think that they can essentially humiliate Trump. He would rather spend the rest of the year with no government than face being called a loser.
Richard Schell, professor of legal studies, business, ethics, and management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. Richard Schell, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.